Librarian Nancy Pearl is with us once again. She has sent us yet another stack of books, which she recommends we read. It's a regular feature we call Under the Radar Books. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Steve.
And the first Under the Radar book is called Under Stories. What am I holding here?
This is a collection of short stories, and I think probably my favorite collection of short stories in recent memory. And the reason is that Tim Horvath writes these stories that are firmly grounded in realism. Then he moves into off-kilter.
Magical realism?
I call it elastic realism.
Go on.
He stretches that definition of realism into places that we might not think it would go. So there are two stories in here that I particularly loved, and one is called The Discipline of Shadows. This is set on a college campus in a multidisciplinary department, the Department of Umbrology.
People who take umbrage? Or umbrellas? What is that?
Right. The Department of Umbrology studies shadows.
Oh.
There's a guy, for example, who studies shadows in film.
All right.
There's somebody there who studies Javanese shadow puppets. There's an astrophysicist in the department who studies the shadows that muons make.
Without even knowing what a muon is, I just want to comment, there probably is an academic department very much like this somewhere in the United States.
I suspect there is, and not only is there a department like this, but this department that Tim Horvath describes is very similar to all the academic departments with its infighting and its people problems among the professors. But the joy of this short story is the sense of this terrific college department. And you end up believing, well, there must be a department of umbrology somewhere that sounds too good not to exist.
Now, you have another short story that you love.
I have one more short story in here that I just want to call out, which is called The Gendarmes. And this is about a young man who hears noise on the roof of his apartment. And he goes up there and he finds a group of young kids and asks them what they're doing. And they say, well, they're conducting an experiment to try to teach animals to grasp the concept of extinction. And then he says, we're tired of having to bail out endangered species. It's high time they learned individual responsibility.
Suck it up, wildlife.
Right. Now, how could you not just embrace a book and a writer who can come up with a sentence like that? It's amazing.
Okay, let's go from this elastic realism to events that actually happened but must have seemed a little bit beyond reality to the people who were experiencing them. It's a history. Peter Stark, Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's lost Pacific Empire. What is that empire?
Well, that empire was really a figment of John Jacob Astor's dream that happened to coincide with Thomas Jefferson's dream of building another country, really, on the west coast of America, past the Louisiana Purchase, and then joining it to the existing United States.
Well, this is when the west coast did not belong to the United States at all. It was
Correct.
Claimed by Spain and by other powers.
Yes. So John Jacob Astor was sitting in his very comfortable house in New York and sent out 140 men and one woman in two different modes of transportation. There was the overland group who were going to go by canoe.
Going across like Lewis and Clark had gone. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And this is just a few years after Lewis and Clark, actually. And then there were the people who were going to go by sea around Cape Horn to come up to the United States. And what Peter Stark does in this book just gives you a sense of the grandiosity of Astor's vision and how it was put into play. And these two expeditions, which were to meet up in Astoria, they were not quite suicide missions, but they were far more dangerous than anybody expected. And out of the 140 people who set out, 61 of them died in various ways. And it's a period of history that a lot of people are unfamiliar with, and I think just a very valuable book in that sense. But more importantly, from my perspective, it's really good reading.
You know, we should mention for people, you're on the West Coast, you're out there in sunny Seattle. There still is an Astoria, Oregon, is there not?
There is an Astoria, Oregon, yes, at the mouth of the Columbia River.
Okay, so we've got elastic realism, then we've got a real story that stretches the bounds of reality, and now let's move on, continuing this kind of theme, to the selected works of T.S. Spivet.
This is a fabulous, fabulous novel. Set in contemporary times, it's the story of a 12-year-old boy, T.S. Spivet, Tecumseh Sparrow Spivet, who is a cartographer, and he maps everything. He maps the dinner table conversation. He maps sound quality as it travels through the Montana countryside where he and his mother and father and older sister live. But T.S. Spivet gets a call one day that he has won a very prestigious award from the Smithsonian Institution for his maps, and he is invited to come to Washington to speak. Now, they don't know that he's only 12 years old, and he gets on a train, and much of the book is his adventures on the train as he travels across the country, mapping everything, getting to Washington, D.C. There's just so much to love in this book. Here's a quote that I found that just struck me, where T.S. says, "Adults were pack rats of old, useless emotions." Isn't that great?
Sad but true.
Sad but true.
In some cases, anyway.
Well, when I go back and think about this book, this is a book about fathers and sons. And this is a book about sons trying not to disappoint their fathers, and yet knowing that they will disappoint their fathers. You could reread this book again and again and again. There's so much in it.
Mapping the world of books. It's librarian Nancy Pearl. Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
She is the author of Book Lust to Go. More recommendations from Nancy are at our website. Also find NPR Book Summer Travel Series, npr.org/bookyourtrip. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Too bright in here. It's time to draw the shade on that cheerful summer sunshine. It is time for another season of Crime in the City. Each year we profile crime novelists and the places that inspire their dark tales. The theme for today's installment, you are not safe anywhere, not even in a small West Virginia town. Writer Julia Keller offers two reasons: prescription drug abuse and heroin. She's just finished her third novel about a West Virginia community and a prosecutor who started her own war on drugs. Here's NPR's Noah Adams.
When Julia Keller talks, you can notice a touch of West Virginia. It's her home state. Her accent may be faded some during her newspaper career in Chicago. So when she started thinking about writing crime novels, she was happy to hear the Appalachian voices coming out of memory.
I was probably the most surprised person of all when I chose to set my fiction in West Virginia. Hadn't lived here in a long time, didn't really know that it moved in my blood, if it did.
Turns out it did. And Julia Keller, the writer, learned it helps when you're imagining something awful, go where it could happen. She had a river she wanted to show me. Rivers, she says, can be mysterious, dark metaphors. One of her books is about the killing of a young girl, and Keller already knew what the riverbank crime scene might look like.
I have to thank my journalism career for that. I was, as a general assignment reporter, once called out to a story. They'd found a car in a river, shallow river, much like this, and the photographer and I went out, and we all kind of waited breathlessly as they were hoisting up the car. Looks like this great rusty behemoth. Instantly, all this red water began rushing out of it, this red substance, and we're all thinking, oh my God, it's blood, and of course it was rust. And then they gave the all clear. There wasn't anything in it. It was just an abandoned car.
To talk with Julia Keller, we've come to a community in West Virginia that is close to where she grew up.
Sign says, welcome to historic Guyandot, established 1810. A few potholes begin to appear in the road, a few more potholes.
Let's say you want to be a crime fiction writer. You start with the main character. Julia Keller invented Belle Elkins. She's a lawyer and absolutely idealistic. And then you need a location. Keller decided to create a fictional town. Guyandot, where we are on this day, was often an inspiration. But the small town called Acres Gap in the novels really came to life just in her mind.
I don't have to make up anymore what's there. I know what's there. I know what the streets look like. I know what the people look like. I know what the courthouse looks like. It is, in some ways, more real than the world that I see. Acres Gap was a shabby afterthought of a town, tucked in the notch between two peaks of the Appalachian Mountains, like the last letter stuck in a mail slot after the post office has closed down for keeps.
That's how she described it in her first book, a disintegrating town, a polluted river, coal mines abandoned. Keller wanted to focus on drug issues in a place with no escape. In her very first scene that she wrote, three old men are in a cafe drinking coffee on a Saturday morning laughing, and someone walks in and kills them. As Keller puts it, poc, 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 one shot per head. Belle Elkins is the prosecuting attorney who will go after the killer. Elkins was born in this town. She'd moved back with her daughter. She could have stayed in a big money career in Washington, D.C.
She could have. She has a law degree from a top-flight university, Georgetown. I mean, her marriage is over, but she certainly had a social life there, a support network, professional and personal. So why does she do this thing?
Elkins returned to West Virginia determined and fierce. Makes mistakes, but solves cases. Keeps a 12-gauge shotgun underneath her bed.
And I love that about her. One of the things I wanted to do with having a female protagonist is to allow her to have her anger. If we let women have a little more of their anger and to speak their minds, we'd have a very different kind of world.
Tell me about this cemetery.
This is Ridgelawn Cemetery, and it's where everybody I'm related to, who's not here anymore, is buried. This is my father's grave here. He died quite young. He was 52.
James Keller had been a math professor. His father worked in a factory, and the Keller men before that were coal miners. So Julia takes special notice of that life. Back when she was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, they sent her deep into West Virginia.
And I had long conversations with the wife of a coal miner there, and she had created a whole section under the kitchen table for her husband with pillows and blankets and reading matter and everything he needed to live because he was only comfortable crouching over.
What Julia Keller heard that day years ago about what could happen to a man who worked bent over underground became one of her plot lines. A retired miner who can't straighten up and has dementia, lives with his young daughter, needs to live in the dark basement. She's put rocks down there and piles of dirt. As the book continues, he is suspected of attacking people in the woods.
Coming up immediately on our right is a gas station that I always think of. In fact, I put in book three, Summer of the Dead.
She's been intrigued by the convenience store gas stations in the West Virginia small towns. Open late, young people on staff. For a crime fiction writer, a place like that is where the stories are just waiting. We stop at the Guyandot station and meet Michelle Day.
What kind of shift do you work?
I work the evening shift, 3 to 11, 2 to 10.
Yeah.
I love working here at this station. I get to meet, you know, I see the same people every day. It's nice.
And Lynn Daniels is the store manager. He says the front door has an electronic lock. The switch is behind the counter.
And that's usually what we do in the evenings. We keep the door locked until we see somebody coming up to the door and, you know, we recognize them or, you know, can tell that they don't have a mask on or anything like that or a gun in their hand, you know. So then we open the door for them.
Julia Keller won a Pulitzer Prize for a newspaper series. She has a Ph.D. in English literature, teaches at Ohio University, and she does love writing about murders, drugs, and kidnapping. Sometimes, she says, people have the idea that crime fiction is a lesser genre.
I cannot tell you how deeply I reject that. Every piece of literary fiction I read these days, I think of as crime fiction, because it is. Hamlet is crime fiction. To Kill a Mockingbird is crime fiction. Heaven knows, Oedipus is crime fiction.
The next book in Julia Keller's series about the prosecuting attorney Belle Elkins is Summer of the Dead. It comes out in late August. Noah Adams, NPR News.
Adam Brooks' new novel, Night Heron, starts with an act of almost impossible bravery. A man named Peanut escapes from a prison camp in western China. Peanut's a powerfully built man, despite his nickname, who was a small boy during the Cultural Revolution and whose father was an intellectual savaged by the Chinese regime. Peanut becomes a ballistics expert but joins the protests in Tiananmen Square, which gets him locked up in that prison camp for 20 years. And when he breaks out, his revolutionary fervor is no longer academic. He has a way in mind to poke a mortal hole in the Chinese regime. Night Heron is the first novel by Adam Brooks, a former BBC correspondent who's been based in China and a lot of other places and is now in the United States. He joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Did this novel start for you with an offer from a stranger?
It was a Sunday afternoon in Beijing. I was in the BBC bureau. A man knocked on the door, an elderly gentleman carrying a little briefcase, and he pulled out of that briefcase two secret documents, Chinese government secret documents, and he tried to make me take them, make me mm-hmm. accept them. I told him I couldn't. I wasn't a spy. I wasn't an intelligence officer. I was a journalist, nothing more than that. But he was persistent, and he tried to get me to introduce him to British intelligence at the British Embassy, as if I would have known how to do that anyway. I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I think the whole episode was a test. It was a test to see if I was an intelligence officer just posing as a journalist.
Or a trap.
Or maybe even a trap. It was some kind of provocation. In the end, he went away. I never saw him again. But his story sort of stayed with me, and I found myself sort of spinning a life around him and spinning motives around him. And it turned into, over the years, it turned into the novel Night Heron.
Tell us about Peanut, this man who comes out of almost a kind of time capsule after 20 years. I wonder, for one thing, not if you ever met anyone like Peanut, but maybe how many people you met that contribute a little something to this character of Peanut.
Peanut's story is one of a middle-aged man in contemporary China who has been through the mill, as so many middle-aged and elderly people in China have, from the early years of communism through the Cultural Revolution through to this huge and very disorienting transition to a market economy. Peanut finds himself sort of traduced by these changes. He finds himself unable to find a footing in any aspect of contemporary China. I've met many Chinese people who've had these experiences where whole slices of their lives were taken out, where they were sent to the countryside to labor with the peasants. Perhaps they were sent to a factory to sweep the floor for years and years and years.
One of the things Peanut discovers is a lot of people that were on the side with which he identified during the time of Tiananmen Square have gone on to other things in life and wind up becoming, at least in a titular way, a part of the regime.
And Peanut comes out of his... I wanted him to be sort of suspended in time, and which is why I placed him in a labor camp up there in the desert of northwest China. And when he comes out, he finds his old friends and his colleagues have become successful academics. They've found their feet in this new China. Mm-hmm. They've understood the way that the lines have now fallen in contemporary China, what you can do, what you can't, how you work the system in your favor. So he finds himself not only at sea with regard to the state and surveillance, but also in regard to his personal relationships. He's unable to place himself mm-hmm. with the people that he sees around him. And this sense of kind of bewilderment among the older generation in China is one that you encounter very frequently. It's a very significant part of contemporary China.
A line that stays with me, a few characters say, China makes exiles of us all. How do we understand that?
I was trying to get across the sense of how, as a Chinese person, a powerful longing to feel a part of your nation and your country and your culture can be confounded by the authoritarian instincts of the state. Mm-hmm. My character, Peanut, sought as a young man to serve his country. He sought to become an engineer. Mm-hmm. He sought to work for the state. He then sought to turn China democratic. He sought to commit himself to political change in his country. And at every stage, he found himself rejected and confounded and later imprisoned by the state. And the sense of the exiled intellectual is a very powerful archetype in Chinese politics. It leads deeply back into Chinese history and literature. Peanut is my latest incarnation of that tradition of the exiled, frustrated, furious intellectual.
Adam Brooks' first novel, Night Heron, Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
Sometimes real life is stranger than fiction, so it makes sense that novelists take some of their best stories from the headlines. That happened with mystery writer Megan Abbott. A few years ago, she was one of the millions of people captivated by news stories about a strange illness that seemed to consume a town in upstate New York. Now, Megan Abbott has taken pieces of that true story and turned it into her chilling new novel, The Fever, as NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
The Fever is Megan Abbott's third mystery, set in the emotional world of teenagers, a place she admits she's a little stuck herself.
I've always heard that Freud said that we're all kind of arrested at a certain age, and I'm embarrassed to say, I think for me, it's about 14 or 15 years old. I feel like that's sort of the time when our emotions are at their kind of peak. We're still figuring everything out, and there's this intensity to it.
So Abbott, who's in her early 40s, was riveted by the TV news stories about a group of teenagers in Leroy, New York.
For months, doctors in Leroy, New York have been trying to figure out what caused 12 girls to have severe tics.
But once the stuttering ended, it soon gave way to uncontrollable twitching.
At the school tonight, they were hoping to learn why a dozen students have been suffering from Tourette-like symptoms.
The accounts gave Megan Abbott all kinds of ideas about what it might be like for these teenagers. In her novel, the girls' spasms often begin with seizure-like attacks in front of their peers.
Her hands flying up, she grabbed her throat, her body jolting to one side. Then in one swoop, as if one of the football players had taken his meaty forearm and hurled it, her desk overturned, clattering to the floor. And with it, Lee's, her head twisting, slamming into the tiles, her bright red face turned up, mouth teeming with froth. "Lee's," sighed Mrs. Chalmers, too far in front to see. "What is your problem?"
In the real case, doctors diagnosed it as conversion disorder, understood to be psychological stress that is converted into physical problems. And because it spread to other students, it was also considered mass hysteria. Megan Abbott says she was fascinated to find out that some of the girls were cheerleaders together. And while Abbott says she only drew inspiration from the Leroy case, her novel revolves around three friends.
And girls in threes, I think, are always dangerous. There's a lot of wrestling for power and attention. And teenage boys, if they have arguments with their friends, you know, can push each other in the locker room or shout things at each other, and girls aren't supposed to do that. So it can often take these more sinister forms, or it can become internalized and turn into something else.
As more and more girls are afflicted, Megan Abbott's fictional town of Dryden is whipped into a frenzy. Health officials are cagey, which infuriates parents. The girls fear it's because they went swimming in a lake that's believed to be toxic. In one scene, there's a tense community meeting at the high school.
The minute Tom walked inside the school, he felt it. It was loud, louder than any school event he could remember. The pitchy clamor of nervous parents finding other nervous parents to be even more nervous together. A flurry of shouts at the door as the sole security guard tried to keep another reporter or producer from entering through the loading dock.
That was very similar to what happened in Leroy.
Susan Dominus is a staff writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. She visited Leroy and wrote an extensive article about what happened there. She says there are some parallels and one very big difference. Dominus says the girls in New York were victims of serious hardships.
One girl had really been all but abandoned by her parents. Another girl, you know, had been violently abused. And another girl witnessed domestic violence between her parents. One of them had a restraining order against the other. She was all but homeless, having left her father's trailer.
Circumstances that Dominus says were much more severe than the ones in The Fever.
The girls in Leroy were all, to me, for the most part, really victims of trauma at the hands of adults. And the girls in Megan Abbott's book were just powerfully experiencing garden variety hardships of adolescent life.
Ambivalence about sex, insecurities about their appearance, navigating the intensity of female friendships. And that's the truth of Megan Abbott's novel, how these things affect the girls and their families, and how a traumatized community stumbles through a crisis. In this scene, the mother of one of the girls says she thinks she knows what's happening.
It's what we put in the ground, she said, and in the walls, the lake, the air, and the vaccines we give them, the food, the water, the things we say, the things we do, all of it straight into their sturdy little bodies, because even if it isn't any of these things, it could be, because all we do from the minute they're born is put them at risk.
The Fever by Megan Abbott is a mystery that raises questions that are nearly impossible to solve. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
It's time now for Weekend Reads, in which we have an author we like tell us about a book that's captured his or her imagination. Before heading out on maternity leave, Rachel Martin spoke to Alexander Chi, the author of the award-winning novel Edinburgh. The book Chi chose is called Astonish Me by Maggie Shipstead. It centers on the life of a ballerina called Joan who leaves the world of dance to have a baby. Alex Chi started off by describing Maggie Shipstead's writing style.
The prose is excellent, but the prose is not stylistically the kind of prose that is flashy. I think of it having a transparent quality, which is to say that you're drawn into the story and more than you are made to consistently pay attention to the style of it. I think what impresses me about her is the way in which she gets out of the way. You don't lose anything, I think, for being the kind of writer that she is. She's not trying to dazzle you with the prose itself. She's telling you a story, and that's the real focus.
In a way, this is a novel about the idea of ceding a dream to a different path.
Yes, I think it's very much about that moment where you take stock as an artist and you ask yourself, is it enough to only be good if I can't be great? And when we meet her at the beginning of the novel, she's in New York City. She seems to have a lot going on for her career. She's just been kind of cast aside by a very famous Russian dancer who she helped emigrate to the United States, and she was made famous by that act. She was elevated, in a sense, by that, in a way that her talent couldn't elevate her. But we don't really know the personal cost of that right away. That comes later on in the novel. What we know right away is that she's pregnant, and that it's early in the pregnancy. Her best friend knows that it's happening to her, and they're in New York going to parties and smoking.
It's the 1970s.
It's the 70s in New York, yeah. It was interesting to be reminded of how in New York City at that time, ballerinas were a kind of disco royalty.
So much of the book is about body image as well, and the female form. I wonder if you could read a passage. This is about Joan's friend Elaine, who is herself an aging ballerina.
She is 31 now, her body already less tolerant and cooperative than it was. Never in her life, not once, has she danced the way she wishes to. But futility has become an accepted companion. The ideal that lives beyond the mirror makes teasing, flickering appearances, but never quite shows itself, never solidifies into something that can be looked at and not just glimpsed. She might surprise it as she whips her head around, spotting during pirouettes, or catch it flitting through one hand or foot. But it never stays.
This book deals with really female themes. I mean, body image, family and work mm-hmm. trade-offs, motherhood in general. Is there
competitiveness.
Something... Competitiveness. Is there something about this book you find to resonate in a more universal way? I mean, clearly since you chose it. Not just to women, obviously.
I was thinking about this actually pretty recently. I think female friendship is something that we usually see the kind of intense romantic side of it. We don't usually see as much, I think, the other side of it, the darker side, the competitive cutting side. Joan and Elaine have a really fascinating friendship because, as it says at one point in the novel, they're not really confidants. They're companions. They're both trying to do this terribly difficult thing of being a famous dancer, of being a great dancer. And I think this struggle that they have and the way that they move between pushing each other on and undercutting each other in certain ways is something that we all understand pretty intimately as as we go through life.
Alexander Chi is the author of the forthcoming novel, The Queen of the Night. He joined us from our studios in New York to talk about the book Astonish Me by Maggie Shipstead. Alex, thanks so much for taking the time.
Sure. Thank you.